Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I am here with Laurent Medelji. He is a really badass jazz player. He lives in Paris, actually, and he goes back and forth between Paris and New York and Miami. He's international. He was born and raised in Paris, started playing guitar at age 12, moved to New York City in the fall of 93, where he studied with Mike Stern and Wayne Krantz, formed his own jazz projects, and released his debut album in 2002 called Circles, live at the 55 Bar, and that's a pretty famous place in New York for jazz guys. His second release on Evander Music was called Diverses, and it features compositions arranged for strings and horns. His next release was a live performance, again, at a really high-level jazz club called Smalls in New York. If you're playing at Smalls, you're the real deal. And that album was called Live in the Village, and his latest release is called Jacaranda Jazz, and we'll talk about some of the tracks on this album during our conversation today. He also played the lead guitar chair in the Broadway play Rent, as well as playing guitar in Hairspray, The Wedding Singer, Evil Dead the Musical, Rock On, Live for the Music, and some other shows. His Latin jazz trio, Latin Amor, entertains for the U.S. Mission at the United Nations, Christie's, the American Numismatic Society. That's stamp collecting, right?
Yes, it is.
That's right. Condé Nast Corporation, the French consulate in New York. I'm going to mess this one up, Laurent. What does that mean?
It's a big credit company in Paris. I mean, now they're all over Europe, but it's a big credit company. I did a few receptions for them. Yeah.
Great. Thank you for not allowing me to butcher that. And he's produced pop artists Lori Vaughn, hip hop artist Dino, as well as Lucille's Mixed Nuts, and they're an instrumental funk band. Man, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure being here, Craig.
You moved to New York City from Paris in 93. That's a pretty big move. And I was curious what prompted you to do that.
Yeah, that was a leap of faith, as you would say. I used to live in England prior. Then I came back to France, and the music scene being what it was back then, for me, it was a natural thing to get across the ocean and see what I could, drum up over there. It's pretty, it's a big leap of faith because I didn't know anybody there, and I just showed up with my girlfriend, my guitar, my amp. The girlfriend left after a few months. It was too much for her. So I was left with the guitar and the amp. And so that's when it all started, basically. Joined a band called Gotham, a jazz funk band. I started helping with the writing of the horn charts and all that stuff. And then we started playing all over, Bleecker Street. Then we went on to Good Morning America. I did a few shows, did a tour. We toured in Germany with them as well. And I guess I was on my way.
So you came over and like things sort of worked out for you.
Yeah. I mean, I helped them work out,
You can't not help. But yeah. But sometimes, the universe supports you and sometimes the universe fights you. But it sounds like the universe supported you on this trip.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big believer that the universe supports us all around. Reason being that we're here. Mm. And there was a giant, chain of causes and effects, action reactions that made us come to this world and be in this human form. And I think that no matter what you do, the universe is going to help you do it.
Very cool. Where'd you move when you first got to the city?
I was staying in Greenwich Village with this French guy that was a student at the Film Academy in New York. So we had a mattress in the living room on the floor, no bed.
Yeah.
And that was my first 2 weeks in New York. Yeah. After that, I got a little job as a data entry processor on the weekend. And I was able to rent a little studio in Times Square. Back then, it was kind of rough, you know, a lot of crackheads and stuff.
Oh, so it's yeah. Really,
I was so paranoid my first days in New York. I never took a cab. I never walked anywhere. I always took cabs, even for three blocks. It was crazy. I never walked anywhere in New York. Imagine that.
Yeah, because if you don't know, I can understand it, because if you don't know, the landscape is very intimidating.
Yeah.
And especially Times Square. That was right before they cleaned it up, I think.
Yeah. That was before Disney. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Very cool. That's a good story though, man, that you came here like that. What was the were there any big like cultural or living differences or challenges that you weren't expecting that you had to adjust to, obviously dealing with the crime or the perception of what's safe and not safe is definitely one of them.
Well, definitely. Well, the thing is, I used to live in England prior, so all my English was British English, right? So I would use words like cheeky, and nobody knew what the hell I was talking about.
Yeah.
I remember this homeless woman asked me to buy her a pint of milk at the deli. And I said, all right, I'll get you a pint of milk. And then she goes, no, I want the powdered milk, which was like $15 or something crazy. I said, you know, nobody ever told you you're a bit cheeky? And she looked at me like, what? No, there was a lot. And, you know, like, especially in the French way, we like to invite people over for dinner and have aperitifs. And, you know, house parties are very common here. And so when I first moved to New York, I would invite everyone over and nobody invited me back. And so, oh, that's really weird. What is wrong with these people? They would say, let's meet in a restaurant and then split the bill. I'd be like, what? What's going on here? Yeah. Some of that was a little weird. I found the human interaction, because everybody's like really into their own thing. Very individualistic. And so I think human interactions suffer from that, yes. they tend to remain superficial, and it's tough to, when you're used to, maybe more of a European vibe, like people are more open, more inclined to sharing, more intimate things, So I suffered from a bit of solitude while I was there, I guess,
Yeah. I could understand that. Yeah. That's interesting. That's really interesting. So like if I went, because I'm originally from there, as you know, if I went to Paris, I would probably feel like creepy for the opposite reason. Like these people, they want to get all up in my business
right.
Yeah. I'd be like, what the hell? So it's just, that's interesting. That is, I could understand that being really weird. Well, I think too, New Yorkers are harder than probably, like if you, like where I live here in Tampa, it's mm-hmm. people are a lot more easygoing, but in New Yorkers, yeah. you got to kind of crack the shell a little bit till they sort of like a make time for you, which is a horrible, sounds obnoxious, but it's not personal. It's just because there's so much scams. Everybody's trying to get something. They're guarded.
That's true. Although there's one thing amazing about New York is the fraternity. People are very outgoing. They'll talk to anyone. You'll talk to a stranger. I mean, I've had strangers tell me about their entire night. It's just because I crossed the avenue at the same time and we started walking along to each other and then just start a conversation like this. And I like that.
Yeah.
See, I think that's very, very healthy and it makes for a better life experience. You go to a bar, you can make friends. Any night of the week, and that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah.
But I wish there were just a bit more of the real substance. The stuff makes us human and want to share stuff. I wish it was a little more common there. Like you can't show up at somebody's house without calling first or making a plan.
Yes.
I like to just say, hey, I'm in your hood, blah blah blah. I'll ring your bell. You're free. You're not. It's okay. We'll do it another time,
That's interesting. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, because you know what? See, I found that people are willing to talk about like substantial, because I don't have any patience for the fish on the wall conversation. I don't want to talk about nothing. I like talking about which is why I like these interviews so much, because they're substantive, you know?
Yeah.
I find people in New York are able to do that and willing to do that, which is interesting. That's interesting that you had that experience. Although, you know, quite frankly, I've been out of New York since 89, so maybe...
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's different, but I always... But part of it's my personality. I have no patience. So, like, if someone's not willing to talk about that, I just kind of move on, because I just, you know, I don't want to talk about nothing, you know. And maybe I
see. Yeah, that's what you do. You adapt to your surroundings to some extent. And once I found out that, you know, this is what was culturally acceptable and what was not, well, I started to, adjust so I could, you know, fit in with the rest of the population. And started to look at who my real friends were as well, you know.
When you came back to France, were you more distant? They say you're acting like a New Yorker.
Oh yeah, it was so tough. The other way around was even worse. I mean, even to this day, I mean, I've had a place here for like 5 years. I'm still readjusting to the French customs. It's just. It's not comparable, you know, especially in the field of work, music, in the music business, in the industry. It's a completely different thing. It's very tough to get people moving on anything. And, you know, email, after phone call, after phone call. It can get frustrating, you know. Whereas in the States, if you have a competence, you know, people will look at you. They'll see if they can fit you in there. You know, their frame of work, their field of action, and they'll give you a shot, no matter who you are. I think that's what I really like about the States, you know, that positive attitude, the fact that nobody cares where you're from, what you know, they care what you do and how well you do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool, you know.
Well, that's the one thing about New York that you'll never have a problem with. Where are you from, or do you have an accent or anything like that? Like, you know, it's not even a thought. And to be honest, it's one of the things I really appreciate growing up there. You know, accents don't scare me, or, you know, to me, it makes me curious, because I want to talk to somebody from a different place, because that guy's got a new set of rules that I might learn something from, you know.
So right.
I like that, you know. And I remember we were out eating dinner here in Florida, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, and the waiter comes over. And my wife says, "Where's he from?" I said, "He's Lebanese." And she goes, "What do you mean he's no?" A buddy of mine was with us. He goes, "I wonder where that guy's from." I said, "He's Lebanese." He goes, "How do you know?" I said, "Because I hear his accent." He goes, "You're bullshitting me." I said, "Ask him." So he asked him. He goes, "Where are you from?" He goes, "I'm from Lebanon." And I like that, you know, that I didn't find his accent odd, strange, you know, or different. You know, I really enjoy right. that about New York. And yeah, people hustle there. The work ethic is really good there, man. You people want to get business done, you know, and shit happens quick for sure.
Yeah. Man. Yeah.
Let's talk about your latest album, Jacaranda Jazz. The songs are, first of all, great album. Thank you for, letting me check it out. The songs
Thanks,
are, yeah, you're welcome. The songs are really smooth. The song writing is, it's very, I don't know how to use the word structured, but I'm assuming you arranged all this stuff as well.
Yes, I did.
Yes.
Yeah.
The arrangements are what I like best about it, because I know this is not a band that's been playing together 20 years, but it sounds like a band that's been playing together for a really long time. Everything was really tight. There was no gaps, everything, you know, no notes wasted. And what I really thought was cool was you're a guitarist, but it wasn't a guitar album.
Right.
Well, I mean, no, your playing served the song.
Yeah, that's what I aim for. That's amazing that you noticed that, because that's really what I shoot for. I mean, I love the guitar, but more than this, I love great music and music that makes sense. And as you said, I have a great team of people. Elizabeth Killijohn on the drums, who spent 10 years in New York. She actually was sleeping and living at Smalls, you know, playing with all the jazz guys. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. She's a trooper. And she has that sound. She has a very specific drum sound, which is a very unified sound, which I really love. And I love her swing, her New York swing. Then I got Nicolas Fabio. Well, we call him Magic Fingers. He's a guy. I told him, look, we're making a record with, it's a quartet with the guitar leading. I don't want a piano sound in this album. I said, I don't want that. I want some cool Rhodes. I want some organ, but no piano. He said, great, fine. And so he went out and he worked out some really cool sounds that vary from song to song just to achieve that, which is awesome because it gives the element of surprise when you switch from one tune to another. Hmm. And he's a great player. I mean, we, you know,
fantastic player, man.
He's a, thank you so much for him. He's a super nice guy too. He's so chill and so nice. And it's really a pleasure working with him. And Francois is on upright. He's really the latest addition. We had to go through a bunch of bass players because, well, those who can't read can play, and those who can read cannot play. So, what are you going to do? You know, and since all my shit is written out, everything is written out, all the charts per instrument, it's all arranged. And I always tell them, look, this is a basis for you to work from. And that's going to work. But if you want to do something else, be my guest, as long as it works. And, you know, more often than not, they just come in and they just read the stuff that's written, and then, you know, here and there, they put a little variation, but mostly they stick to what's written because it works. And so Francois, he's also a composer. He's got a great record out as well. And he came in and his sound and his feel was so, so cool. I said, you're in. You know, of course, they freaked out when I said, we're going to do the album in like one afternoon. They were like, what? Are you crazy? So what's wrong with you? Everything's written. You know, yeah, come on.
You recorded that whole thing in one afternoon.
Yeah, we did that in one afternoon. Yeah, set up and everything.
Shit.
Yeah, most tunes are just one take, no overdubs, you know, and that's how we did it.
I hope you had a good party or a good bottle after that, because that's a lot of work to do in one afternoon, man. It really is.
After that, we all went to bed. Everybody was passing out.
That's a lot of work in one afternoon. You know what? Your keyboard player, it's almost like he's part of the rhythm section. It's kind of hard to explain, but I found him so essential to it, like he was part of the bottom, like holding it together. It was really weird. That's unusual for a keyboard player. You know, he was just very involved in everything.
Oh, he is. And I mean, of course I come in. All the keyboard parts are written out, you know, with chords and everything. But I tell him, look, you know, you can adapt this the way you want. But he has a very solid foundation to work from. Mm. And since I am the leading instrument, you need that support, you know, and he's very good with harmony and everything else. So, you know, in a seven note voicing, you will hear one note that kind of rubs and they'll be like, oh, look, are you doing this? Are you doing that? And this is the kind of guy I love to work with because, you know, obviously I'm orchestrating for the whole band. Hmm. Some things are going to slip through and he's very alert and his sound makes him part of the rhythm section, but he also complements some of the melodies with me
you guys almost did call and response. Not note for note, but verse, you know, your verse and then he did a verse. So it was really cool the way you guys had that exchange, man.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It's a lot of fun playing with this guy, for sure.
So that was recorded in France.
Yeah. The Medel Jazz Quartet is my latest project that originated in Paris. And all those guys live in Paris, but, you know, we all travel the world to make music. So, I had several other Medel Jazz embodiments, if you want, but this one is really my favorite because of the players involved and and the style, the Jacaranda jazz. It's a style of jazz that is aimed at people that are not specifically into jazz. Mm. You know, catchy melodies and of course the tradition is also there. You can hear it in the soloing and the ideas and the improvisations. But I wanted to make a record that is accessible to anyone who doesn't particularly like jazz, you know?
And it was. It was really accessible because I'm not a big jazz. I mean, I appreciate the music, but the record was good. The melody, I liked the songs. The melodies were nice. That's what I liked about it. You know, it wasn't. Improv was very, again, it served the song, man. It worked really well within it. So was your tracks all improv? Like, or did you know? I mean, you said you did it in one cut. Was that stuff worked out ahead of time or did that just?
Well, I think we did about two rehearsals before we went into the studio, but we had played those tunes live before.
Okay.
And so, the theme, the melodies, all that's written out. And then all the solo sections, they're all improvised, like, you know, on the spot, basically. Hmm. So, yeah. Yeah. And it gives that fresh element. And the fact that we didn't, you know, go back and cook the recording, which is, you know, use the live tracking that we did.
Yeah.
That gives it that spontaneous, you know, energy, which I love.
Yeah, it was very spontaneous energy. It was very good, man. I did enjoy that. I want to ask you about a few of the songs. First song, If Only, you're holding your, what is it, a 175, you said, or?
Yeah. Okay. It's a 135. Yeah. Gibson.
And that's the jazz box guitar sound you have in that song, If Only.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. I messed it up and you told me yesterday it's If Only. Sorry about that. Is there like a meaning to that title? It sounds like there's some sort of a If Only blank.
Yeah. You want to hear the rest, right?
Yeah. What's the backstory to that?
I'll tell you what, you can't have the rest. It would fill up a book. Okay. No, I'll tell you what, you know how sometimes there are situations in life where, well, let's talk about maybe romantic relationships. Maybe that's a more specific example, but it can apply to other fields as well, where you have a person that you really like and that has so many qualities, but then there's that one thing, that is unsurmountable, that you try to live with, and it's so huge. It's only one thing, okay? But it's so big that you can't deal with it.
Yeah.
And so that's what sponsored that idea. It's like if only, you know, if only
you didn't have that one. That way, yeah.
If only you didn't have that
one thing.
Yeah. How many situations, how many times in life you're like, oh, if only this or if only that. Hmm. Although this is not the way I live my life. I look at what great blessings I have in my life, and I try to be, you know, always grateful for everything I have, sure, which I am. But I know that this is a pattern that the mind can go back to, saying, if only this, if only that. You know, somebody might say, oh, if only I had a girlfriend, if only I had money, if only I had a job, if only I had this. So in this particular case, it wasn't about this. It was about probably a person that had so many amazing qualities, and that one, I don't want to say it's a defect, but that one trait of character that made them unable to make certain decisions, for example, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what sponsored. And there is a certain nostalgia in the melody. But it's powerful. It's not, you know, it's not really a bad. It's more like you're observing something with the most possible detachment to it.
That's a really good story. I had a question for you though, as you're talking. When you're in France, how much time is spent speaking English and how much time is spent speaking French?
I mostly speak French here, although I call the States a few times a week and I speak to some of my friends there for a few hours, you know, while I'm sipping on a nice rum from Martinique or Guadeloupe. <You
know? laughs> I ask you because your English is really great, man. Because,
oh, yeah?
Yeah, well, because your vocabulary is for someone who's not natively an English speaker, your vocabulary is really good. And it's because it's okay to speak English within a certain framework of, you know, 100, 200, 300 words, but your vocabulary is beyond like the normal guy living in America speaking English.
So, thanks, man. Well, you know, I studied English. I have a master's degree in English.
Okay.
I still have a degree from Cambridge University in England.
Okay.
So actually, my English was much better before I moved to the States.
See what I'm saying? You got destroyed here, man. Yeah.
Yeah, no. But I did learn a lot of good slang. So I was.
That's good. You can curse with the best of them.
Yeah.
This is funny, man. When I was in England, because my wife is from there, I don't know, maybe 1997, 98, I don't know. I went to Cambridge. And I went there specifically because this is like a nerd story. I read it. I watched the DVD. I watched the making of Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd.
Okay.
And Roger Waters said he wrote that song, The Lunatic is on the Grass, about a patch of grass by King's College Chapel on Cambridge. So I went there. And I had a Walkman. That shows you how old it was. I had a Walkman with two headphones, one for me, one for my son. And we sat there on the grass listening to the song.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was very cool. Oh, you know, it would have been appropriate to have a joint at that time, but he was probably like, I don't know, nine. I don't think so. But that was beautiful there at Cambridge.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah, they had a big mansion in Grantchester Meadows. It's called near Cambridge.
Yeah.
And what I would do at night, you know, when I lived there is I would just, you know, basically borrow a little one of those little punting boats they have, you know, to go on the camp, which is the river.
Yeah.
And it's really eerie, gorgeous at night because the river comes up with a mist.
Yeah.
And it looks like a horror movie. And here we are, like four or five of us. You know, punting on the cam with all that weird fog coming up is pretty cool. Drinking beers and stuff. So they're from there. They had, I think they still have their mansion there, the Pink Floyd. Or they had it back in the day in Grantchester Meadows.
They have a song called Grantchester Meadows. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah. There's a Grantchester Meadows song on their older one of their early albums. But that whole that was beautiful, man. That was just absolutely gorgeous. It was really
British countryside is pretty. It's pretty hot. It's one of a kind, definitely. Yeah.
Very nice. A Wolf in Spain. On that song, you got a great kind of like a walking bass line, and I got the feeling that between that and the keyboards, it's almost like a mysterious, you know, like. A mysterious sounding vibe that I got off of that. Yet at the same time, it's a very up tempo song.
Yeah. Well, this is a song, you know, sometimes you could work for like 10, 20 hours to write a tune. And sometimes you do it in 15 minutes. It's done. This is the latter. This song came to me and was basically wrote itself out in like 15, 20 minutes. And then the part of orchestrating and arranging it for the whole band, of course, took longer. But the basic idea was that, and the reason for the title, well, my totem animal, I was told by a shaman in Chile, is the wolf. So I have a, you know, special connection to that animal. I think they're beautiful and they're very loyal animals. I mean, they live in a pack. They have a family that they raise. And they live with them until they die. It's pretty awesome.
That is I didn't know that. That's really unusual for an animal to have that, isn't it? Like animals don't usually. Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
They're raised like mom and pop wolf. They raise their kids, and you know, if they had a school, they would take them to school. They have the school of life, so that's good enough. Right? So the wolf in Spain, that mysteriousness for me is embodied by the wolf, and the fact that the harmony. To me, there is definitely some Spanish-y harmony in there. You know, there's some Phrygian stuff going on and whatnot. But it's got that. It was for me the visual was a wolf, you know, strolling but casing out his surroundings, seeing what's going on. Where's my next meal? What am I? You know, how am I gonna get out of this? You know, and the Spanish harmony led to the title, A Wolf in Spain. And this band, the Medellin Jazz Quartet, does a great job at rendering this tune. Again, one take. We just didn't have time for more. This tune was completely orchestrated top to bottom for every instrument, the entire song, except of course for the improvised sections, like the keyboard solo, the guitar solo. It's the song that's getting the more airplay worldwide right now, by far.
I like that song a lot. To me, that's the strength of your record is the orchestrations. I mean, it's so tight. It is really, I was blown away, only because I knew this wasn't a band. You know, you listen to the Grateful Dead, you know those guys have been playing together forever and you could get it, but I knew you guys aren't playing together that one. That was to me the strength of that record by far. Melody's great, but to have that shit together like that, man, that was very impressive. Maybe Led Zeppelin 1, but you don't hear too much unison like that on a first record. Another song, the last song, Honey Groove. Again, I thought it was like really cool sounding, again, a little bit mysterious. And it sounds like you almost had the same settings or similar settings as the guitar in If Only. And I was curious if you happen to remember, you know, was that close or...
The Honey Groove is the track that closes the album because I think it's one of the most modern tracks that I've composed for the Medellin Jazz Quartet. And it's really a groove tune, you know. It's got a lot of funk and groove in there.
Yeah.
But it's a Honey Groove because it's sweet. There's a certain sweetness there. There's, again, you know, I'm very attracted to the animal world when it comes to music. I think nature makes music all by itself every day, everywhere. And so if you picture, the strength of the bear chasing for honey, it's got a certain groove to it, you know. And so there's an element of mystery because we don't know what's going on in the bear's head. Hmm. At least I don't. So they do their thing. And they love honey, and so that's why I call this track like that, because of that element of sweetness and mystery as well. The sound of the guitar is much more bare, pun intended, you know, in this one. Much less effects than in If Only. If Only, I have a thing that makes my guitar almost sound like a fretless guitar, but not quite. Mm. So it's one of my secret recipes. In Honey Groove, on the contrary, I wanted to go for something much more minimalistic and to really have that really close to the ear kind of sound for more of a, like, maybe a woody, not that kind of woody, like, you know, in the woods experience. You know, to link back to the bear idea, and I think it works well. It's a pretty short tune. It's got a nice groove. It's got a bar in there in the middle of 7/8, which was a little tricky to make it tight with the band, but we did it. And so I like that tune a lot. Actually,
that was a nice tune to close, an appropriate tune to close out the album with. I thought it was cool. That placement of that was good as well. When you write, do you think in English or in French or both?
When I write music?
Yeah.
Well, no, my stuff comes out in English because I didn't go to school for music here in France. And so when I moved to New York, I started to work on the jazz and everything else. And everything I learned was in English. So since I've been back in Paris, and the English is much shorter, much more to the point, which is great, you know. So my stuff tends to come out in English. I mean, they understand me most of the time, you know, the musicians I play with. But there's certain things like expressions like double time feel, or there's certain things that are not – you can't translate them into French. It would take, like, you know, have to paraphrase, and it takes too much time. Mm. So I say them in English, and then I show them what I mean. So, you know, English comes first, I think, when it comes to music, for me anyways, yeah.
It sounds like having these visualizations, like with the bear chasing the honey. It sounds like that really helps you work through an idea of how you want the sound to come out.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, same thing. Why did I call this album Jacaranda Jazz? When I was in LA a few months ago, I was stunned by the beauty of that tree, a purple tree, the fragrance, really strong, but sweet and light at the same time. And then I find out it's used, its wood, its bark is used for making guitar fingerboards.
I was like, oh,
really? And it's also got amazing properties, like healing properties. Mm. And it's been known centuries for that purpose. So I thought, well, the music that I do, this is what I want to try to recreate, is with sound. Let's try to connect the senses with the visual and the scent as well. And so that's why you have this big purple tree on the cover of the CD. And, you know, people say, what are you selling? Like, you know, gardening tools or whatever? No.
No, I didn't. That's appropriate for an album cover. I didn't think it was weird at all.
Yeah, no, I like it, but it's maybe a little unusual. You know, people put their faces on there or their instrument. Like, if you look at the cover, you would never know this is a guitar-led album with a quartet of modern contemporary jazz and funk and, you know, with some soulful bits as well. So, I like to try. For me, there's always a visual story to a composition. Like 99% of the time in what I write, there is an element of visual involved. And yeah, it does help me. I'm like a movie maker, except I don't have the moving pictures.
I could see that, because your media is not movie. Your media is music.
Right, exactly. And with the sound, I try to convey that story that's unfolding in my head. And a lot of the times, I'll come up with a musical idea, and that will link itself to an experience or a landscape or a region of the world or sometimes a dish, a meal that I had or a special drink I had somewhere. And it'll trigger all these other elements that then I will try to put into the song, you know?
Yeah. You're a visual in general, right? You tend to think visually as opposed to emotionally or even auditorily, because I think so, correct? Or no?
You could say I'm more of a visual person, maybe, yes. But I have a very, very strong sense of smell as well. Like, I smell everything. Unfortunately, as you might know, the metro in Paris is not the best smelling area in the world.
No, I didn't know that. It's bad.
Oh, it's crazy. You know, I wish they took a freaking shower once in a while, you know? What's going on here?
The reason I said it is because on Facebook, sometimes I see you post, you'll post a meal or something, but it's not just a meal. It's like a nice aesthetic visual. And it's like a meal that you might take a picture of in a magazine.
Well, thank you so much. I love to cook. It's true. And yeah. I love to experiment with different recipes that I make up as I go along.
Yeah.
But, you know, did you know that, you know, the pleasure we derive from eating is 75% visual. And that's scientific.
Really?
Studied that. Yeah. It's only the taste only amounts for 25%.
Wow. So that's interesting. Well, yeah. I'm just thinking, because I'm like a kind of a bodybuilder guy, and I eat like protein shakes and yogurt all day. I don't know, or oatmeal. I don't know. I'm looking at them thinking, God, I have a bad visual if that's what I'm eating all the time.
The satisfaction comes from that, both things. But first and foremost is the visual. That's why when you see, you know, chefs that are, you know, that are, have awards and stuff. Mm. Their presentation is magnificent, you know, and the taste follows, of course, you know.
I didn't realize that. That makes a lot of sense now. That makes a ton. Yeah. And you know what? I don't have a sense of smell either. So I can't. So I'm like, food is, I'm lucky because I eat that way that it doesn't matter to me. So I could walk by something. It doesn't, I could get, you know, a bowl of oatmeal and someone's got a giant bowl of pasta with fresh sauce or whatever. It doesn't bother me. But that's interesting. Now that makes a lot more sense. I didn't realize it. That's cool.
Yeah, you should pimp out your shakes with little umbrellas and stuff.
I'll keep that in mind, man. Thank you. Note to self, put umbrella in protein shake. How'd you first get turned on to guitar at age 12? That's really young. And when did you know you wanted to play professionally?
Oh, well, I was in summer camp. And obviously the guys in charge, they had a guitar. And I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. So I learned the three chords. They were singing a song that had three chords. And so that was in the summertime, like July or August. And then when I came back to my parents, I said, you know, I want a guitar for Christmas. And so they got a guitar from a friend that had been broken. It was all like glued back together. It was, and I started driving my parents crazy, trying to play along with the radio and sounding horrible, obviously. But I didn't stop. That didn't stop me. And so I kind of fell in love that summer with the guitar. It was like a love at first sight. And then I did, you know, I got through my heavy metal thing, AC/DC and all that stuff. Iron Maiden, all those guys. I was really heavy into that when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, my parents said, okay, he's freaking out over guitar. Let's give him some classes. So I studied classical guitar, which was very remote from AC/DC and Iron Maiden, those guys. So I did
not
it for
so
a
much
year.
From Iron Maiden, definitely from AC/DC. Iron Maiden, you could some of that is not too far removed from some classical stuff.
Right, but when you have like a nylon string guitar and you don't, then you're like, you know, what am I doing?
Yeah. So how long did that last for?
I did that for a year, and then I quit. My teacher was freaking. She said, you know, next year you'll be doing concerts everywhere, blah blah blah. I said, look, I want to play some rock and roll.
Yeah.
So then I got a job, but like, you know, I was working for all my school vacations and bought my first electric guitar. Yoo-hoo!
What'd you get? And what was your first guitar?
I got like, it was a copy of Les Paul.
Okay.
It was like, I don't know, I can't remember what it was. Oakland or something like, I can't remember the name. But it did the job for a bit. And then I took the music as an option for my graduation year at the lycée. And I got... The guy was a substitute teacher. He was younger. And so we were like four or five in the beginning of the year. Everybody dropped out except me. And he was doing a master's degree in musicology and especially jazz and Brazilian music. So we started, you know, analyzing all those tunes from back in the day, like, you know, some Stanley Clark tunes and stuff. Wow. And I loved it, and he turned me onto that. And halfway through the year, he says, look, Laurent, I'm gonna start making guitars. I said, what? He said, yeah, I love guitars. I said, make me one. And so he made me my Strat, which I still have, and I use in most of my other projects that are non-jazz projects. And handmade guitar, one in the world. Love that guitar. It's a custom Strat, obviously. And it's got a really great sound. It's not the typical Stratocaster sound. It's got other things going on. And I've used that on countless records and sessions, and it travels very well. You know, it's a great guitar. So that's how I got my first like handmade guitar, is by studying music in school, basically.
Well, that must have been great too, because you were the only student. So you had the whole teacher to yourself to do whatever the hell you wanted. That was probably a lot of learning.
And then we started hanging out and going out to parties and, you know, drinking together and stuff. It was like, it was great. It was the best teacher ever, you know.
Is he still making guitars?
I think, no, he moved on to make basses, actually really great basses with the Alembic system.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. He was the main guy at called Bass Center here in Paris for like 12 years. I think he's kind of retired now. Mm. Yeah.
When did you get that 135?
I got it in New York in like 20, I don't know, 2007.
Where'd you get it?
And I got it. I bought it from some dude. I had to go out to Queens, Bayside in Queens, yeah. if you know the place. And my phone is into me. And yeah, I was, and then he takes me, so I go there. I've never been there, right? So I'm like, where the hell am I? And he gives me, he takes me to his place, and it's like in the basement.
You thought you were going to get stabbed or something.
Yeah, I thought, is this a serial killer? What's going on here? So I brought the cash with me, right?
And so all sorts of shit's going through your head.
Oh, I'm freaking, I'm looking cool. I'm trying to zen up, but yeah. You know, I'm not bold or anything, you know?
Yeah.
So, what happens is, he's like, please go ahead. I'm like, no, you go, you go first. So we get his basement. He gives me his guitar. I start playing. I'm like, wow, it feels really good. I'm like, oh, cool. And then he waits and he says, you know what? He says, I think it's a perfect guitar for your playing. Cause he heard me play. My playing has got, you know, the regular, like the jazz stuff, you know, yeah. Some bebop and whatnot, but it's got also a lot of more modern elements, you know, and he heard me play. He says, I think it's the perfect guitar for you. I said, all right, sold. So I bought it from him and I had to schlep it back to Manhattan and then of course to Paris, you know.
Wow. Well, it's a beautiful guitar, like, man.
Thanks. Yeah. I really like it. They don't make them anymore. It's a navy blue. It's not black.
Yeah, that's what I like about it. But it's a real deep. I mean, you know, it's got like it's almost like sunburst navy blue. It kind of fades in and out. It's really cool looking.
Yeah.
Is that like the Howard Robbins model, or they make something like that?
Howard Roberts. Like that. Yeah, it's not too far, but this is better because I've played the Howard Roberts. And it's a good fusion guitar or blues guitar, but this is much better. I changed also the pickups. I got some pickups made for me that are PAF 57.
Is that like classic 57s?
Yeah, exactly.
I have those in that 335. They're amazing. And I have it in an SG. They're phenomenal pickups. I love those.
Yeah, they're great. They had to you know, settle in. It took a couple of years, but the sound really opened up with those pickups. And altogether, it's my go-to guitar for anything that's non-pop, you know, that's jazz and stuff. Even maybe for some fusion stuff. I mean, I've recorded some rock. I've done rock sessions with this guitar. It handles the distortion very well. And you know, depending on what I have to do, I might use it too. But this is my jazz. I love this guitar. I mean, there may be a better one out there for me, but I haven't seen it yet, you know.
I want to go back to gear in a minute. I just want to ask you a couple more questions about your career. When you first started playing professionally,
yeah,
what were the biggest surprises about the music business itself? And did you have new surprises when you came to the States about the music business?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, you know, it's funny to even call it the music business because it seems that every law, common sense rule that applies to any other businesses doesn't apply in the music business. You know, it's so crazy, that thing, because there's such a strong element, emotional element attached to making music. So I've seen it. Not going to say I've seen it all, but I've seen everything from the charlatans that tell you, oh, yeah, you're going to have the moon. I have a special, I have a special way for you to get to the moon. Look, watch me. And those other ones. And then the artists, some artists that, when I was a musical director, that are shocked that, you know, I'm doing three people's jobs, so I'm getting paid three times as much. Oh, no, that's no good. And then they go around and ask the musicians, how much are you getting paid? How much? I mean, would you imagine, like, you get somebody in your house, you get a interior designer to redo your living room, and then you ask the workers, how much is he paying you? Oh, that's not right. You know, I mean, this is not like what we call, regular business attitudes. And so I've learned it the hard way that you have to expect like unreasonable behaviors in the music business. You know, between those that want you to work for free, those that want you to work, but they're always going to ask you for the extra, which I don't mind. I don't mind, you know, I always, you know, give 110%, but
you like to get, it's not unreasonable to expect to get paid for that though.
I wouldn't think so, but for some people, I mean, especially here in France, they're saying, oh, what, you're doing what you love? That's not work. Like, what? Excusez-moi. What's going on here? No, it's a very strange thing. I mean, at least in the States, people are, you know, musicians are respected for what they do. And especially if they know that you have, like, a resume that's, consistent with, like, Broadway work and stuff like that.
Which is really difficult, which is not easy work at all.
No, it's anal. It's very specific, but it teaches you how to be super accurate, both in your intention and delivery. Mm. And where does the guitar fit in this, 23-piece orchestra? And that's what I learned from playing on Broadway, which, I'm not a musical theater fan by any means, but I really enjoyed working with the bands because those musicians are amazing. The orchestrations are the best in the world. And I was lucky. I worked on major shows like Tony winning shows.
Rent. Yeah.
Yeah. That's Rent, huge. Spring Awakening and other shows that I did like that. Hairspray.
Yeah.
Hairspray was a blast. And I made some great friendships with some of those musicians as well. So that's really a great experience. And I kind of miss that, going in the packed theater on a Saturday night with no rehearsal and just, going through the fire, especially the first time you play the show. That's pretty nerve-wracking,
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, I miss that. Pushing your limitations, pushing your boundaries, makes you a better musician and a better person because you can develop compassion for other people around you because you've been through that yourself and you can put yourself in their shoes and try to have some empathy, for people that are maybe at a different stage in their own development, So, yeah.
Has that been a struggle? Like when people have unreasonable expectations about, they want to pay you less than what you're worth and that what the job should be paid. Was it a struggle or is it a struggle for you to, I've noticed most musicians get very awkward around money. Not all, but most. And yeah. And in general, I think I've been working for myself for 20 years and I've realized early on, you have to take care of yourself. If you don't feel your value is here, you're not going to get it. Was it tough for you in the beginning to have to step up and say, hey, that's not really acceptable and I need to get this?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, the thing for me, I did all sorts of odd jobs. I worked in restaurants when I was in New York for the longest time. And little by little, what happened is that I started getting more paying gigs. I mean, better paying gigs, I'm not talking about the $50 gig, whatever. I'm talking about better paying gigs. And little by little, then all of a sudden I realized, oh, I probably could support myself now with the music. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened. So after getting fired from a bazillion restaurants, obviously that wasn't my thing. Yeah. Although I did enjoy bartending. Bartending was fun. But I just, little by little it came in and the money came in and that was that. But it's not really a struggle. You have to know what you're willing to do and for how much. Hmm. So the thing with me, as the wolf thing is I'm very loyal. So even though I may be a hired gun, I will stick it out with somebody's project for years,
Yeah.
And I'll become part of the family of that project to make it happen. So not everybody behaves like that. That's the way I live my life. I try to do that as much as possible, and I'm pretty successful at it. So I can work with a project for many years. Somebody who hires me, they'll know they can depend on me. Obviously, I do a bunch of other stuff as well. But no, in the beginning, you tend to get anything that comes your way. And then I guess as your experience, grows, you got to know what you're willing to do and for how much.
Yes.
I guess my something I'll never forget. I had this experience with this singer that was doing a CMJ festival. It was a rock, pop rock thingy. And she couldn't play any guitar, really. She couldn't play guitar. But she had recorded some guitar licks and whatnot on her songs. And she wanted me to play exactly those licks. So I was having to forget how to know how to play, right. which is pretty dramatic when you spend your entire life becoming a better musician and work as hard as you can.
Yeah.
And I remember there was this bass player, this chick. She was a Rasta girl with big dreadlocks. She was really cool. And on the break in the rehearsal, she said to me, I said, oh, I feel like shit. I don't know what's going on. She says, yeah, she broke your spirit, she says. I said, what do you mean? She says, well, she asked you to play the shit that doesn't sound good, and your spirit is hurt right now. And I'll never forget that, because we only have one spirit. And you don't want to go around breaking pieces of it, because you can never glue it back together.
Yeah, and once it gets broken, man, it's a down. Oh. It's a continued downslide of destruction.
Yeah, that's how you get depressed. You know your life has no meaning anymore.
Yeah.
So very careful with that, and that's why you need to know what you're willing to do for how much, and always try to derive some joy from what you're doing. That should be your first priority. And then, you know, if it pays the bills, even better.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. Which is hard. You know, everybody's got to eat, you know, and it's hard whenever you're a freelance, anything, you know, you always have to do some work that you really wouldn't rather not do.
But look, I did a record last summer of a Celtic punk rock band. Okay. Which is super far remote from jazz,
right? Yeah.
But I told the guy, I need everything written out. I want charts. I want shit music. And that's it. So he had done everything MIDI. And so I had to redo everything on the guitar. Some stuff was just not guitar friendly at all, but I had to just like make it work. And I enjoyed doing that. I did like 11 tunes of that crazy stuff, you know, drunken in a bar. The guy couldn't sing, but he had this deep voice. It was like that. And that was a lot of fun for me, you know. That was a lot. Actually, when I was in New York, I was in a band called the Baghdadios, like a punk rock band. And we used to play all over these village CBGBs and everything. And I made a deal with him. I said, I'll never rehearse with you. Not once. He said, okay, you're in.
Well, you set your boundaries. There you go. It worked within your parameters, so you're good to go.
Yeah, that's right. Very and good. I told him, to even if we have a gig and Broadway calls me, I'm going to have to go play Broadway. He says, of course, no problem. They were very cool, those guys. We had a blast.
The Baghdadios.
Yeah, that was fun.
Switch back to guitars. You said that, I know the 135, the Gibson ES-135 is your number one. What would be your number two?
Well, it depends on what kind of music I do, but that's my number one for jazz for sure. I really enjoy that guitar. Then for my other projects, like when it's funk, or I just did a record, like a neo soul funk R&B record. And I used the Stratocaster I was talking about that was handmade for me back in like 85, I believe. And that has seen so many changes over the years, like the pickups and the this and the that. I had it refretted in New York by a young guy called Easy, did an amazing job. And it sounds great, and it's you know, it's beautiful. It stays in tune. It's like, it's really cool. So I use the Strat, and then you know, I have, of course, I have a nylon string Alvarez guitar, semi acoustic, which I really like as well for anything like, you know, Brazilian or world or whatever type of music. And then I have also a Takamine, like a folk guitar, which is more of a high end guitar that I use if I need to play some folky stuff or whatnot. And then, you know, I have a few others. Like I have also a handmade Telecaster that is...
I have a hard time picturing you playing Tele, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that one is got a... It's a handmade one with a very thick fingerboard, maplewood touch, and it's a great blues guitar. The guy got me... It's the same guy who did the Strat.
Oh, okay. He got
an old pickup from the 60s, you know, back then they had them like in wax. And so it's a humbucker, but one of the coils is broken and you can't fix it. So only half of the pickup works, but it sounds so good. It's amazing. So I kept it in there. I said, I don't care. Give it to me. It's like right from the 60s, like a vintage
rock. Yeah, that's really cool.
So guitar has a beautiful, beautiful bluesy sound, really cool sound. Yeah.
That's cool, man. If I asked you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order, and knowing this can change tomorrow, right now, what would be the first three CDs that come to mind?
Right now, I would say I would go with Weather Reports, Live in Tokyo, which I love. Great energy. I think that's a timeless piece. Of course, I'd have to go with a record by Wes. Also live. I love live recordings. The Smoking at the Half Note record.
Yeah. You know how many guys I interviewed tell me that that's their favorite, one of their top three by Wes?
Really?
Yeah, plenty of people. Yeah, very much.
Wes Montgomery is so musical and, you know, so flawless and so it makes it sound so easy, you know. It's, you know, his guitar really sings when he plays. It's amazing. And then I would have to go with something like, you know, Chick Corea Returned Forever or something like that. So I really, really like his writing and his playing as well, you know. So, yeah, I would take those three. I think I'd be pretty happy with that.
That's an old, that album, Return to Forever, I don't hear that as much as I would think I would. I don't know why. That's a pretty major album.
It is, and maybe it's been, you know, overdone, and people like, yeah, of course, yeah, I love that record, but there's been so much done since then.
Yeah, and I think that's
come to mind.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. What's something that you've learned about yourself along this entire journey you've been on?
Well, I've learned that I have to be a musician. I don't really have a choice. Not that I couldn't do something else, but the only thing that, you know, gives me a raison d'être, as we say, you know, a reason to live, is making music. I guess music chose me. Choose music. Kind of, but not really. I got hooked on it, and you know, I've made peace with that. I mean, of course, there's other things that would probably be very exciting to do and stuff, but I'm pretty happy with that, knowing that, you know, I'll be a musician for the rest of my life. It's totally fine with me. And knowing that the universe will support me in doing that also, you know.
I'm assuming you grew up in a super positive environment.
Super positive? Not particularly. Actually, my parents were trying to dissuade me from making music from a very early age, because they were both singers. That's how they met. They met in Paris because they had the same coach. They both came from the south of France. You know, back in the 60s, if you wanted a job, you had to come and move to the capital city. Mm. And that's how they met, fell in love, and here I was. And then, you know, that I was there. You have to put bacon on the table, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
So... So my dad quit his musical career. You know, he had a deal with CBS. It was called, what was it called? Barclay, back in the day. Barclay, CBS, yeah. And I was. So I guess I have it in my genes. And they always told me, life as a musician, it's a mess. You have no guarantees, blah, blah, blah. So that's why I did a master's degree in English.
Interesting.
So that I could always fall back onto being a teacher, which I was for a bit. Hmm. I was a translator. I was a teacher. I was an interpreter for some companies. And I still went along, you know, and kept working on the music part in my life. So I took a long route because I never really went to school until like a couple of years ago when I was in Paris. I went to school for 1 year here to work in composition and arrangements and stuff. And, that was good.
Yeah.
Great to be in school and wanting to be there was really a great experience, you know. And And the rest I had to learn by myself and study by myself. Remember, there was no internet, no YouTube, no nothing. It's just books and some private teachers. Mm. And then the rest is for you to do the work, you know?
Interesting. The reason I had said that is because you're very confident. And I sense that your confidence is genuine when you say, oh, the universe is going to support me in this all the time. So that's why I thought, oh, you must have grown up with a – because that's a big – when you're that confident in saying it, usually that has to be instilled at a young age.
Oh, I wasn't always like that. Maybe that will explain it. I'm really attracted to Buddhism.
Okay.
I think it's a philosophy of life that I can really relate to. Mm. And in Buddhism, there is no victims. There's just a chain of cause and effect that leads you to the place where you're at. Hmm. So in Buddhism, a person, an individual is responsible for their own happiness.
100%.
You know, 100%.
I agree with that.
And so that, you know, I used to be a yo-yo. I used to be up one day, down the next day, very pushy, always mad at people for not getting back to me in time and stuff like that. Until I kind of, you know, well, I did a lot of research myself, certain books that I read that really, really changed my life. But when I got really deeply rooted in the idea that the universe will always sustain you and help you for the very simple reason that you're here, was when I kind of discovered the Buddhist philosophy and tried to really embrace that right away. And also Taoism, the Tao Te King, is one of my favorite books ever. There's a great translation by Stephen Mitchell in common English, because the original is it's beautiful poetry, but yeah, you can't make any sense out of it, you know?
Yeah.
You need to read it in like proper, you know, everyday common English language, and then you can really hit home. Really great little tiny book, you know. I read it in 10 minutes at the gym the first time.
What's it called?
The Tao Te King. It's spelled T-A-O-T-E and C-H-I-N-G. So Tao Te Ching, really, it's spelled. Okay. Yeah.
When you said 10 minutes, I said, okay, what is the title?
I didn't finish. The first time I read it was 10 minutes on the bicycle at the gym, or 15.
Yeah.
Then it took me 3 months. And then the next time I picked it, well, I had it all the time, but when I started to read it again, after 6 months, I came across someone I thought needed it more than me, and I gave it away. Hmm. So it's the kind of book that, you know, you could read 2 pages and it's going to trigger so much stuff.
Yeah.
That you just have to close it and just like let it do its work, you know?
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I wish, you know, I could give that to people that, what you call a positive, for me, it's not specifically a positive thing as more of an observation, you know, a factual observation.
Hmm.
You know, like you don't believe in the sun. The sun is here.
Yeah.
And this, you know, gives life to us because of the energy and the heat that it provides and everything else. You don't need to believe in that, in the sun, for it to do its work.
Yes.
That's why I think it's not, that's why I say I know that as opposed to I believe that. Because
yeah, that's what I was impressed with, because your conviction when you said that, and you said it 2 or 3 times. That's why I wanted to ask you about that, because that was very, I think that I believe if you think something's going to happen, it will. If you think it's not, it probably won't. And I like your conviction in believing the universe is supporting you, because it's a lot more likely, much infinitely more likely to happen that way when you are thinking that way. And even if something comes and interrupts it, you're not going to look at it as I'm off the, it's all over. You're thinking that that's going to be part of that, whatever thing that knocks you off the that particular road, that's part of the support, and that means this next road is, you know what I'm saying? And I think that's a healthier way to look at things than not. I think it's a healthier way because you're always in a positive, you know, zone. It's a lot easier to maintain positivity like that.
Well, the thing is, once you know that, you realize that whatever obstacles come your way, it's just a temporary thing, and it doesn't affect your foundation. It's, you know, it might shake you up a bit, but really, we don't know the ins and outs. Is this a positive or a negative thing? It's like, I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you, and I'll give you a scoop. I just canceled my contract with my record label. And I did that because their actions or their lack of actions proved to me that they were not the right people that I should be associated with. Mm. And, you know, they agreed right away, went without a cent. So now I'm looking for a label.
Right.
You know, but knowing that the next guys that I'm going to work with, I'm going to be much more, you know, I'm a trustworthy kind of person. You know, I take your word for granted. You tell me you're going to do this, you're going to do that.
Mm.
I say, great. And then until you prove me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I was wrong this time. And so now I'm on the hunt for a new label. And, you know, I can't help but say to myself, look, this is a good thing because the next guys you're going to work with are going to be, you know, stand-up people, and they will promote the album the way it should be.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's the way I look at it, you know.
Yeah, I have this saying, you can't connect the dots moving forward.
Right. Know?
And so I always try to look at, or as best as I can, try to look at like an interruption or a change or a disruption even as, okay, that's just the message that's not the end of it. It's, you know, okay, this is going to be a good thing. I just don't know what that good thing is going to end up. And I may not know it for a couple of years or 10 years. You know, but I know this is a good thing. You know, I just don't know what that good thing is going to look like in the end, you know?
Yeah, you're right. We're oftentimes we're very quick to judge things for being good or bad or beautiful or ugly or whatever. And we don't really have any of the data to support that judgment.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
We're just, you know, we make an assumption and that's it. You know,
yeah, expectations. You have expectations and you have no framework really for having those expectations, because if you were in control, it would have happened already. You know, you wouldn't be on the journey. Yeah, you'd be at the end, you know.
Well, the thing that you're in control of your own actions, and your actions will determine, will cause some reactions.
Right.
So, you know, if you get up every day and do your work and take the necessary actions, some things will change.
Right.
I mean, you will get to the results that you want to get sooner or later, maybe later than you thought, or it may come up in a very different way,
right,
shape or form. But you will have accomplished things if you take the actions.
Right, right. I think that's the
thing that, for me personally, keeps me going. I'm not, you know. A long time ago, I realized that because I know the universe supports me, I'll always be taken care of. I always have food on the table and a roof and some heat and a hot shower, even though I lived in New York with a cold shower. You know, that was a trip. I had to run the hot water through the coffee maker. Yeah.
Sorry, man. I'm not laughing at you. I just, it's common. It's just the way it is, you know.
And then once you're wet and soaked up, dude, you ain't got a choice. You know, you got to take that soap off one way or another. And if it's cold water, well, so be it.
I was on the phone with, I told you I interviewed Oz a few weeks ago, and I'm on the phone, and all of a sudden I hear this thing like, and I said,
yeah.
I said, hey, is your wife moving, or is somebody vacuuming there or moving something? Because it's really loud and I don't want to mess up. You know, I want to hear your audio. And he goes, oh, no, that's my heater. It's like, because it takes about 50 and it bangs like that until the heat comes. But that's the way these old buildings work. You know, it's just like what you're talking about.
Is that in New York?
Yeah. He's in the upper west side. Yeah. And it's just, I was like, oh, okay. So we had to just, you know, thank goodness it was just stopping them, but it was like, holy shit. That's just the way those old buildings are, man. No matter how good they look, you know?
It's the thing. There was like a bunch of little gnomes living in the pipes.
Yeah.
And banging and doing work at night.
Yeah. That's the way. That's
the way. Yeah.
Hey, do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music? I know you're like cooking.
Yeah, I love to cook. I love martial arts, which I practice, you know. I mean, I've had a surgery on one of my knees like last year, so I had to stop. Mm. But I like martial arts. And what else? Yeah, I love movies. I actually do make music for movies whenever I get a chance. And what else do I like? I love nature. You know, I love being out in nature. Sports, I'd rather play them. That I'm not into watching sports. You know, unless I'm at like Yankee Stadium and there's a game, then I'm fine. But I'm not into TV sports or any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Rather play something, play a game. I love tennis, swimming, the ocean. You know, because I lived in Miami for a couple of years. That was great, living right on the beach. Beautiful experience. And I go back pretty often to get back that experience. You know,
cool, man.
So yeah,
you got a lot of hobbies. Yeah. You're very well,
I guess.
Very balanced, man. Just to ask you a couple more questions, Laurent. Number one, sure. What is your favorite food in France and your favorite food in New York City?
Okay, so what I love in New York, I love the steakhouses. So I love a nice ribeye steak, you know, with the seafood bouquet to open up.
You are a foodie, man.
Yeah, I love that stuff. Although I love a good burger, I guess you know, the corner bistro, my burger place. I used to go there because I live not far from that. It's an awesome burger, inexpensive. So yeah, I love a good burger, a good steak in New York. And here, well, you know, you have your croissant, your pain au chocolat, but I have to say the bread, the baguette. It's so simple.
Yeah,
you know, hot, fresh out of the oven. It's killing. And I have three bakeries downstairs from my apartment, and they make bread all day long, and more often than not, comes right out of the oven. It's warm. I bring it upstairs. I'm like, oh, this is so good.
Nice.
The cheese, some good cheese. Oh, and a good bottle of red wine, because wine is so inexpensive. It's like, you know, for 3-4 euros you can get an awesome bottle of red, really tasty, with some good bread and cheese. You're in heaven, you know. And good company, of course. I mean,
you know. There you go. And the last question, man, how do you, and you maybe have talked about it a little bit, but what's been the biggest change in your personality over, say, the last 10 years? And how much of this change has been deliberate, and how much do you feel is a natural part of aging?
Well, I would say, like, to go back to, you know, when I discovered the Buddhist way of life, I would say that was a major, major change in my life. Because it grounded me into pursuing my own happiness without having to depend on any kind of outside influence. So basically, you know, look on the inside and find your own joy. That was it. So that was probably the biggest change I've had happen to me. And then the aging part, well, I guess when you age, you get to know yourself better, and you know what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. And although I'm still very flexible, I think, you know, I can do a lot of stuff because I love what I do. And I like to support up and coming artists and share my experience, you know, on several continents and try to help them, you know, build their career that way. But there's things that I won't do anymore because I'm just not there, you know.
And I give you credit and congratulations for applying that in severing your ties with your label, man. I think that's a big move, and I'm happy for you that you did that. You know, it sounds like it fits in line with all this stuff that you're talking about. You know, it's always people talk a lot, but when you implement, that's, you know, that's what's impressive to me anyway. You know, you could have all these lofty thoughts and ideas, but when you say, well, and as a result, I did this, I'm like, man, okay, that's a guy who not, you know, he's not bullshit. And he's just talking. He's believing in his, he's implementing and executing the stuff he believes in, which is always hard, you know? So good for you, man.
Yeah. It's something you have to bear in mind. And you know, it's tricky because if you respect yourself, there are certain behaviors or certain actions that are done onto you or that involve you that you will not accept. You will find unacceptable.
Hmm.
And I think that's the basis. How can you have people respect you if you don't respect yourself?
Yeah, 100% right. I agree. People treat you the way you want to be treated, for sure.
Right. And I do the same thing. Look, I'm a musical director. I hire musicians all the time. You know what my measurement of what I should pay them and how I should treat them is?
Hmm.
They called me with the same gig. I would jump up and down and say, thank you, sir. And so I treat them like I would like to be treated. And
yeah,
that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, people know me for that. They know that, you know, when I call them, I'm going to try to lay out the red carpet. You know, I've pick you up with your drums, drive you back to your home and give you a nice fat paycheck, you know, because that's what I would like to get. And that's what I normally get. But, you know,
so all the musicians in France listening to this, you're going to hit up Laurent.
Yeah, they're going to hit me up like, oh, give me a job.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, man, I want to just turn people on to your music and tell them where to go. I really appreciate your time, man. I really very enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Me too. Cool, Craig. Yeah.
Everybody, I want you to please support and check out Laurent Madalji. And let me spell his name because it's not an English name. Laurent, it's L-A-U-R-E-N-T, Madalji, M-E-D-A-L-G-I. Laurent Madalji.
Sorry, Craig. There's one little mistake.
I messed up.
M-E-T-E-L.
I'm so sorry. I really apologize, man.
It's a common mistake. Everybody makes it.
Okay, let's do that again.
That's why the band is called Medel Jazz.
Yes.
Because I'm Med.
Yes.
You know?
Totally makes sense. Let me do that again. It's Laurent, L-A-U-R-E-N-T, Medelji, but it's M-E-D-E-L-G-I. So look him up online. Please check out his album, Jacaranda Jazz. It's a really nice album. Really good composition in the songs. The band is tight as shit. And check it out on Spotify. Add some of the songs to your playlist. It's also available on iTunes, Amazon, and all the usual places. Again, it's called Jacaranda Jazz. And Laurent has other records out there. He's got Circles, Live at the 55 Bar, Live at the Village, which was recorded at Smalls in New York. And he's also got that's it. Yeah, and Jacaranda Jazz. He also does freelance work, and he's a musical director, so anybody looking to hire a guitarist or looking to come to France and play and needs to get booked and needs supporting musicians, look him up online, and he's your man. He's been around the block. All right. Any final words of wisdom?
Hey, Craig.
Yes.
Everybody loves guitar. It's the best blog on guitar out there. I love what you guys are doing. And I follow it, and it's so awesome that the community of guitar players, whether they're, you know, veterans or burgeoning, they have your blog to go to and hear about gear, hear about people's experiences. I think it's awesome. And let's spread the word on what you do for, you know, guitar players out there.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it. Man, I appreciate your time, honestly. And you're real good getting to know you, and I appreciate you sharing as much as you did. So. And I wish you continued success. And if I ever get over to France, I'm going to come check you out. And you're going to show me how to get a baguette and a $4 bottle of wine.
I definitely will, man. I will. You should come out. You should come out and, you know, treat yourself, you know.
I should. Everybody, I want to thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Laurent Madalji for spending time with us. I appreciate it. Check out Jacaranda Jazz. Check out Laurent. He's doing good stuff. And go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified of future episodes along with some early product announcements and discounts. And remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.